We asked dental professionals why they use Sensodyne for their sensitive teeth.
I find that Sensodyne is the best one.
I can enjoy my ice cream as I want to. I don't have to be afraid or embarrassed of my sensitivity.
I can eat my ice cream when I use the Sensodyne, and I can drink my cold gin and tonics.
It does the job.
79% of dentists with sensitive teeth trust Sensodyne to care for their teeth. Based on online research conducted in 2023, survey of 248 dental professionals, Haleon data on file. Sensodyne, recommended by dentists, used by dentists.
Welcome to Dentistry Talks, a podcast where we speak with exciting voices from outside of the profession to bring you fresh perspectives on dentistry. I'm your host, Gabby Bissett, and we are thrilled to have you tune into this episode. As we all know, dentistry is not just about teeth. In this podcast, we delve into conversations with remarkable individuals, bringing you stories, insights, and lessons that transcend the dental chair. Whether it's a successful business person or a record-breaking athlete, our guests share experiences that have important connections to the world of dentistry. We hope their stories and advice can help you to reshape the way you approach dentistry, be it in business, personal development, or providing the best patient care. We have an exceptional guest joining us today, Dr. Naomi Sutton. A graduate of Sheffield Medical School, she now works as a consultant physician for the NHS, specialising in sexual health services at Rotherham. Driven by a passion for education and reducing stigma, Dr. Sutton has dedicated her career to raising awareness of sexual health. But her commitment extends beyond the medical field and into the world of media. Some of you may recognise her from E4's The Sex Clinic, a programme offering sexual MOTs, STI tests and treatment. Get ready to gain valuable insights into the world of sexual health and how and why this is so important in dentistry. Well, hello.
Hello.
Nice to finally have you here.
Thank you for having me.
It feels like it's been a long time coming, us two having this conversation, yeah. Since you wrote that piece for us a few years back.
Yes. Well, it's nice to meet you in person rather than on a screen.
It is. We are going to be talking about sex today, which for a lot of people watching as a dental audience might be a bit weird. They might be thinking, why is this relevant to us? But we're going to tell them why over the course of the next 45 minutes.
We are.
For those who don't know who you are, would you mind just telling us a little bit about your career and how you got into sexual health?
Yeah, so I'm Dr. Naomi Sutton. So I'm a sexual health consultant. I work in Rotherham. I studied medicine at Sheffield and then went through all the training. I think I realised quite early on that I wanted to be a specialist in something, so a medic rather than a surgeon. And plus, it's probably become quite obvious, I'm quite clumsy. I've already fallen over today on the way in. So surgery was definitely not going to be my specialty. And I didn't really want to be a GP, so I did all my medical exams. And initially I actually wanted to do palliative care because I like talking a lot and I like the psychology of people and getting to know what makes them tick, I suppose. But I did an SHO job, which was SHO at the time, in sexual health and realised this was the speciality for me. And the more I've done it, the more I just love it and I'm so passionate about it, and it's such a positive speciality. So there is nothing that you can't make better, manage or treat in sexual health. So even sexual dysfunctions, or you know, HIV is manageable, syphilis is treatable, all these things. So it's a really positive specialty if you can get people over the door. But we are still, you know, hugely plagued by stigma because, you know, sex is a stigmatized topic.
Absolutely.
For a lot of people.
Absolutely.
But again, it's a very strange concept because we all generally as human beings like having sex or want to be having more sex or having different types of sex or whatever, yet we find it incredibly embarrassing often to talk about, and especially when you have problems or symptoms, it can often be very difficult to present to healthcare professionals and bring that topic up.
Definitely.
Which is why I'm so passionate about educating everybody and trying to reduce that stigma that surrounds it.
Yeah, I mean, that's super important. I think the word stigma is something we're going to tackle a lot today.
Yeah.
I think sexual health is definitely not a topic that dentists and dental professionals are too familiar with. And that's why I'm really excited to be talking about it with you today, because we can break down that stigma and work out just how dental teams can incorporate this into the day-to-day and where the boundary lies, where they maybe shouldn't get involved.
Yes, 100%.
where it isn't their business. So, I mean, the theme of this podcast is sex is sexual health. So you've spoken a bit about that already, but what does that mean to you? What does sex and sexual health mean to you?
I think, so what we have to remember is that we should all be able to have our sexual rights met. And that means we should be able to have the kind of sex we want with dignity, consent, integrity, mm-hmm. you know, be open to whatever we, however we see sex and intimacy. So it's not, you know, we live by, especially in Western culture, sex is often seen as a very, in a heterosexual word, it's a penis into a vagina, which drives me mad, really, because that's just a societal script. And there are lots of other ways of having sex, and, you know, it doesn't have to be that way. So again, I think it's just about trying to get people to think about sex in different ways and just be healthier and reflect on maybe thoughts, patterns that we might have that mm-hmm. are maybe unhealthy and not suiting us. But that often takes a bit of a deep dive into our own culture, our own background, our own education.
Absolutely.
Just to sort of weed out those little weeds that are maybe not healthy for us. And again, that will vary from person to person. And I'm not here to say sex should be this, that, or the other. Mm-hmm. I'm here to say sex should be whatever that individual wants to do, as long as it's consensual and with a partner that's also consenting.
For sure. I think a good place to start today would be, why is this relevant to dental teams? And I know before this you mentioned two STIs or sexual health conditions. You can probably be more specific about the technical terms for them that are relevant to dental teams. And one of which I was really surprised about, which was syphilis. So you said syphilis and HIV. So, I mean, it's up to you which one we kick off with. But
well, I'm going to kick off with syphilis. So lots of STIs can affect the mouth. So mm-hmm. I'm not going to talk about HPV causing oral cancer, because I think there's a lot of information out there already. Gonorrhea and chlamydia can also sit in the throat and infect there, but often that's asymptomatic, mm-hmm. so it's not something that a dentist is going to come across or any oral health professional. But syphilis is a biggie, and the reason I want to talk about that is because I think for a lot of people and a lot of the lay public and other health professionals think syphilis died off with kind of Van Gogh.
Well, exactly. I said this to you before, didn't I? I said syphilis, that I associate that with kind of like 19th century, and I have just disclaimer as well, history degree, so I should probably have known better that wasn't the case. But I had that exact image in mind when I thought of syphilis.
Yeah, and it's one of those sort of really old STIs that, you know, when I was training anyway, I rarely saw. So if I tell you a bit of history about it, just to put it in context.
Yes,
so, in the sort of early 1900s, we didn't really know what it was caused by. It was about 1906, I think, that we discovered it was caused by a bacteria. But in those days, the only treatment was mercury and other sort of horrible heavy metals, which generally killed you off before the syphilis mm-hmm. did. But there were asylums full of youngish people or middle-aged people who were dying of tertiary, so late stages of syphilis. So it was horrendous, hugely stigmatizing. Back in the day, there was no social support or NHS or anything like that. So if someone did get syphilis, you were left, you know, if it was your partner, for example, mm-hmm. you were left penniless and out on the street. So it was hugely problematic. So the Venereal Diseases Act was made sexual health care available to anybody in 1918.
Okay.
And so we have records from that point onwards. So rates of syphilis from kind of 1918 onwards were maybe in the 6,000 to 10,000-ish rate. That's incidence of people presenting with syphilis.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was in 1943 when penicillin was found or invented. I don't know how you say that, but we discovered it. And we discovered that treated syphilis, that there was a huge spike in incidence because, you know, very quickly became obvious that this was treatable. Come and get treated. It mm-hmm. was free. So we saw a huge, huge drop in rates of syphilis. And that kind of carries on. So very, very few cases until sort of the 1960s, 1970s. And if we think about what could have changed behaviours around there, there was the pill, combined oral contraceptive pill. So it was the start of, you know, the feminist movement, mm-hmm. women could have sex out of marriage if they wanted to without the fear of pregnancy. Homosexuality was decriminalised in 1967, I think it was, yeah.
Late 60s.
Yeah. So, you know, so behaviours, cultures, things were changing. Sex was becoming much more about pleasure rather than just, especially for women, rather than just about procreation. Mm-hmm. And then, obviously, everyone will know about the AIDS epidemic. So that was first reported in 1981. But there wasn't the UK AIDS campaign until 1987. Mm-hmm. You'll be far too young to remember this, but anyone over anyone over the age of 45 might remember there was a, you know, an advertising campaign. Everyone got a leaflet through the door, and it was hugely significant, I suppose, in how people saw sex outside of monogamous relationships, and pretty much sex stopped. And so rates of syphilis, therefore, are sort of, you know, they hit a really, really low, a really low level. Mm-hmm. And then that kind of carries on. Obviously, there was no treatment for HIV for at least about 16, 17 years after the first cases that were reported. It was, 1996 was when we had effective antiretroviral therapy. Okay. So that was the first, so protease inhibitors came on the market. So we knew then that we could start to treat HIV, so people stopped dying. And because, again, I think we have to go back to the point that people like having sex. Yes. People go back to, oh, okay, we'll test the waters again. So as people have more sex, you know, rates of STIs go up. So syphilis started bubbling up again. But again, not huge numbers, a couple of thousand a year. And then recently, in the last sort of 10, 15 years, rates of syphilis have gone in a really steep curve. So we've gone from kind of, you know, 2,000-ish cases to about 8,000, just under 9,000 cases.
Well, that is a growth, yeah.
Last year. So we have to think about what's changed and why this has happened. And I think there's a few factors. One is that sexual health budgets have been cut drastically. So capacity has dropped massively. It's up to 20% budget cut. So that's had a big impact. And I'll explain a bit more about that, because if you do present with syphilis, often these symptoms will go on their own. So if you can't get into your sexual health service at the time, you might just go, oh, it's gone, I'm
think
fine.
Nothing else think of it.
Exactly. But there's also changes in behaviour. So we know from the NATSAR studies, we are having more sexual partners. Condom use is less of an issue, especially with the U equals U campaign, or the campaign about HIV means that you can't pass it on. So anybody on taking antiretroviral treatment for HIV, which is 97% of our UK population, cannot pass this virus on to sexual partners. So that, therefore, is brilliant to try and reduce stigma, but it is a double-edged sword, because people then don't need to worry so much about condoms for HIV, but then there's all the other bacterial infections, etc., that potentially can be passed on. And then there's PrEP, which is pre-exposure prophylaxis for HIV. So for those at high risk can take antiretrovirals to stop them getting HIV. So again, that's another backup, which sometimes means that then they're not going to use condoms. Although although I think people either use them or they don't use them, I don't feel that PrEP encourages people not to use them. So I don't want people to get that confused and stigmatise anyone. And also, I'd just like to point out, for anyone who feels PrEP is in any way a bad thing, you know, we prescribe the contraceptive pill, the coil, the implant, so that women can have heterosexual sex with a man without getting pregnant. So again, we've got to be equal for everybody and allow people to have the kind of sex they want. And then there's apps. So sex is very, very easy to find nowadays, and lots of people will have anonymous sex. And so for us, that makes it very difficult then to contact trace. So if we can't find who the infection came from, we are at a loss to try and stop the onward transmission, if that makes sense.
Yes.
And there's, you know, there's lots of other sort of factors, but you know, behaviours and society will change, and it will continue to do so. And, you know, in a lot of ways, that's a really good thing. It's a very positive thing.
Sure. Yeah.
But we all just need to be better educated and do more testing.
I think you made that point to me before we had this conversation. You know, it's great that people have the freedom and feel they can have the kind of sex that they want to have.
Yeah.
But an inevitability of that is that STI rates will increase.
Yeah.
So with that in mind, why is this relevant to the dental team? How does this manifest in the mouth?
So syphilis, as I said, is a bacterial infection. Mm-hmm. So if you are in contact with someone who has the infection, you will pick it up via that skin-to-skin contact. So it's transmitted via mucous membranes. So that can be the vagina, the anus, the mouth, mm-hmm. or nipples even. So the bacteria will get in wherever the point of entry is.
Okay.
And at that point, you may or may not, so about 30%-ish may have a primary chancre, which is an ulcer. So very often these primary chancres are painless.
Okay.
Although not always so. I will say syphilis is always known as the great mimicker.
Okay.
So although I'm going to give you some, some basic outlines, syphilis really can present as anything. So that's
doesn't make it easy for you, does
it? No, that's the difficulty. But in general, if you read a textbook, most people describe the painless chancre as a rolled-edged, fairly deep ulcer that's often painless.
Okay.
Now, if you've had oral sex, for example, with an infectious penis, for example, that might be in the back of your throat
mm-hmm.
or on your tongue or your hard palate or your lip.
Yep.
So that might be the first thing that a dentist may see. And again, if they've not complained of anything or it's painless, that might just be an incidental finding.
For sure.
Now, when I spoke to my lovely friend, Ben Teague, the gums guy on Instagram, I said, what would you actually do in that case? And he said, most dentists would refer onto oral medicine.
Okay.
Now, I don't know what waiting lists are like for oral medicine, but I know if it's anything like the NHS, it's going to be a few weeks at least.
Yeah.
Now, the problem is with all signs of syphilis is they will melt away and disappear whether you've treated them or not. So if a dentist saw an ulcer that they didn't know what was going on, by the time they got to oral medicine, it may have gone. Now, I'm not sure whether oral medicine would automatically test for syphilis and mm-hmm. HIV. I'd be very surprised if they did. It'd be brilliant if they did. So what I would always suggest is any kind of ulcer is you explain, I don't really know what this is, but we're going to refer to oral medicine. One thing I think is really worth you doing is popping to your local sexual health clinic and getting a screen
mm-hmm.
because otherwise you've missed that opportunity.
Yes.
So that's your primary chancre. And, most people don't have any symptoms. So you're lucky if you do have one, really.
Okay.
And then the infections become systemic. So it spreads all around the body.
This is if it isn't treated?
Yes.
Yes.
So if it isn't treated, it becomes a systemic infection. And that's what we term secondary syphilis.
Mm-hmm.
And the symptom, and this would be much more likely for you to pick up symptoms in the mouth with this stage. I think it's about 60 to 70% was quoted in one textbook that I read about oral manifestations mm-hmm. being picked up in the secondary stage. But for us, as general medics, it may present with a widespread rash, often affects your palms and your soles.
Mm-hmm.
So I was talking about this earlier.
Yes.
There is nothing else other than hand, foot and mouth, but that generally affects children.
Uh-huh.
That affects your palms and your soles in this sort of rash-like presentation.
So syphilis stands out in that respect then?
Yes. about 25% of people will probably get symptoms of secondary syphilis. But often, the rash will go on its own. You might get some hair loss, patchy alopecia, pathognomonic of syphilis.
Okay.
You may get abnormal LFTs, cranial nerve palsies, lymphadenopathy, but in the mouth especially, or it is, you may get these what we call mucus patches.
Mm-hmm.
So these are shallow ulcerations, and we also call them like snail track ulcers.
Okay.
So very shallow, and they often sort of follow like a little slug's slid or a snail, obviously a snail. A snail has trailed along the lip or mouth. So that's really important that we test for that one.
Yeah.
They may have lymphadenopathy at the time. Which again is a good thing to check for. And the other thing that sometimes you might see is condylomata lata. So these are kind of warty type growths, incredibly infectious. All mm-hmm. these symptoms of teeming with spirochetes, so the bacteria, very, mm-hmm. very infectious, these lesions. So again, same process. Please refer on, please get testing. All these symptoms will go again. even if they're treated or not treated. So often in medicine, we kind of, you know, we sort of safety net and go, well, don't we know what it is, but if it gets better, don't worry. If it doesn't, come back and see us.
Mm.
But in the case of syphilis, this is the totally wrong advice to give.
Okay.
You've got to get tested, otherwise we'll never know. So we're pretending someone doesn't get treated. You are then infectious from the moment you pick up syphilis mm-hmm. until about 2 years' time, where it becomes sort of latent and you generally become less infectious.
Okay.
But if you're not, if you don't get tested, doesn't get treated, you can potentially infect quite a lot of people in that time span.
I was about to ask, so if, say, this hasn't been picked up, be it by a general medic or by a dentist or a member of the dental team, why is it important that it is picked up? How can this then look, say, 4, 5, 6 years down the line? What impact does this have on a carrier, basically?
So that's that, and that's the biggest worry. So as we talked about, you know, all these people who were dying in the asylums back in, you know, turn of the 19th century,
mm-hmm.
this is potentially what we're going to see. Well, hopefully not, but you know, the worry is that we're going to develop symptoms of tertiary syphilis.
Uh-huh.
So if you don't get treated, and again, lots of people will never have symptoms, so this just carries on, you don't get treated.
Uh-huh.
Anywhere really between 2 to 30, 40 years, you can start to develop symptoms of tertiary syphilis. And probably about a third of people with untreated syphilis may go on and develop complications.
Mm-hmm.
And they can be dementia, memory problems, psychosis, nerve issues, heart problems, problems with the big vessels in the heart, your aorta, and also gummers. So gummers are sort of, they're benign growths. So you may see a gummer in the mouth mm-hmm. that looks like a horrible ulcerated deep so it probably looks very like a cancer.
Okay.
So something that you might refer on. Now I presume those kind of lesions would get biopsied. They're not going to disappear on their own, but again, that's a very late stage of syphilis, and we can prevent those from happening if we treat at an early stage.
Okay.
But again, that's kind of, you know, that's worst case scenario.
Further down the line.
We don't want gummers.
Okay.
We don't want it to get them. But you know, there've been cases where, you know, people have had testicles taken off because it looks like testicular cancer, and so they can be in any part of the body, organs or bones or skin.
So this type of development, if I can just jump in there.
Yeah.
Is that something you're seeing at the moment, or is this something you fear could start to materialise more as years go on?
So the cases I was talking about, the numbers of cases going up are infectious syphilis.
Okay.
So this is the primary, secondary, early latent, mm-hmm. so within 2 years of picking it up. So, but with those increasing numbers of early syphilis, we're worried that potentially years down the line, we're going to start seeing problems with that. It's difficult to know because the data is from the pre-antibiotic era, and it may be that with all the antibiotics swilling around, we see less of this sort of tertiary sequelae. But you know, either way, we don't want to risk that happening.
No, absolutely not. So there may be some people listening who are thinking, this is a bit of an awkward topic to talk about with my patients. Obviously, dentistry is a bit like your job, actually. It's very people-centred.
Mm-hmm.
You have a lot of people coming through your doors, particularly if you work in NHS dentistry, but private dentistry too. A lot of patients coming through, and a lot of them who people have seen for years and years and years.
Yeah.
They could be, you know, 60 and have been their patient for 30-plus years.
Yeah.
How do they navigate these conversations, and where is the line? So how would you recommend dentists and dental teams bring up this topic if they feel it may be relevant to a patient?
It's not easy.
No.
And I'm not saying it is easy, but obviously we're not going to do it when they've got the mouth open and you've got some tools in the mouth. You're going to do it as you would. So I guess if someone was thinking they've got an ulcer, they're worried it's cancer, for example.
Mm-hmm.
In the same kind of way, you're going to sit them down and go, look, there's something in your mouth that I've noticed. I'm not really sure what it is, mm-hmm. but I need to refer you on to, you know, to rule out this, that and the other. I'm obviously not a dentist. I'm rubbish with mouths.
That was about right. I don't know.
But so how I would hope you could say it is, you know, this could be blah, blah and blah. One thing because of this podcast I was listening to, and I know is on the rise, that we need to rule out is syphilis and HIV, which I'll talk about in a minute. Mm-hmm. Because otherwise I think you are not doing a good service for your patient. So it's a little bit like saying, if it was a smoke, if you saw something that looked like oral cancer, you're not going to refer.
I see, yeah.
If they're not a smoker, for example. So my point is, you don't have to ask what kind of sex they're having. You don't have to ask anything about sex. Don't even mention it. Uh-huh. Because it's an indicator disease. Okay. So it's something that you've seen, and within your differential, you need to rule that out. Whatever kind of sex, however old, whether they're black, white, mm-hmm. green, spotty, old, young, you need to rule this out.
Yes.
Because it's a bit like seeing, you know, what you thought might be an oral cancer and going, yeah, but you're only 34 and you don't smoke. You would never do that, would you? You'd refer it on and get it checked, mm-hmm. biopsied. It's highly unlikely that it is oral cancer because you're not a smoker and you don't chew tobacco and you don't drink lots of alcohol, blah, blah, blah. But I just want to get it ruled out. Mm-hmm. So very similar in the same kind of way. Most of these cases will not be syphilis, I hope, but you'd be missing a real opportunity to, you know, deal with the potential long-term health complication.
Absolutely.
If you don't refer on. And, you know, you can ask them, you know, just pop down to your local STI clinic, your sexual health clinic. So, you know, it's worth knowing where yours is, so that you can just, or, you know, have a number. Your sexual health clinic, I guarantee, will be more than happy to give you leaflets, cards, whatever. We welcome any kind of referral because, you know, we can sit in our little clinic wanting people to test more, but we can't do anything about it unless people send, you know, people come in and get tested.
This kind of holistic approach to healthcare.
Yeah.
Referrals and such.
100%, yeah.
You mentioned HIV.
Yes.
Which is something that probably is more in the vocabulary mm-hmm. of dental teams.
Yeah.
But would welcome your advice, your guidance on that one as well. So, I mean, you can give us a little bit of history of that too, if you like. Like you said, I think it is a little bit more known, the history of HIV, but how can that manifest in the dental?
Well, so first of all, I want everyone to know that anyone who puts on their form they have HIV and is taking treatment is not they are the healthy ones.
Yeah.
So, you know, people worry when they're taking blood still, oh, they've got HIV. It's the people who haven't been tested who could have HIV that are the risk.
Yeah.
So people on treatment have an undetectable viral load and are, you know, far less risk than someone who's never been tested. So, and I'm sure lots of, you know, dentists are totally aware of that now. When we look at figures and data, there's probably about 4,500-ish patients undiagnosed in the UK with HIV. So that's quite small numbers. It's about 100 over 100,000 people living in the UK with HIV. So small numbers left undiagnosed. But the biggest worry are those who have been diagnosed but are out of care.
Okay.
So the numbers of those we estimate anywhere between 4,000 and 22,000. So it's a very big number. Yeah. People may have left the country or died or moved area and be under care somewhere else. But that's the bundle that we worry about. Because so the undiagnosed and the people out of care are not on treatment. And therefore, they're at risk of their immunity being damaged.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's some British HIV Association or BIVA guidelines which talk about indicator diseases. And so for the mouth, they would be... So indicator diseases, sorry, I should put that in context. Indicator diseases are signs and symptoms that should prompt HIV testing.
Okay.
So these are... these are indications that your immunity is very low. And so your CD4 count, which is how we measure the immunity, is generally less than 350 or lower.
Okay.
And I won't bore you with CD4 counts, but, you know, that's basically how we measure it. Anything more than 400 is normal.
I was about to say, where should it be?
Yeah, 400 to 1,200. Yeah, no, it's a good question.
Okay.
When your CD4 counts start dropping, we start seeing strange, wonderful... Well, not wonderful, but, you know, strange infections and problems happening to people. And it's a sign that your immunity is being damaged.
Okay.
And that can be, you know, people with other immune deficiencies can also have similar problems. But so The things to look out for in the mouth for these things are Kaposi's sarcoma, mm-hmm. which is a specific type of cancer, but that could present as like a purplish, lumpy plaque, I suppose, or a flattish plaque. So it's an epithelial cancer that can affect the skin or any of the mucous membranes in your lungs or your gut. So in the mouth, you may see these purplish patches, or, you know, on the face. Mm. Again, my unexplained lymphadenopathy is a big reason to test. So if you were feeling the neck and you found all these bobbly knobbly lymph nodes, that's a good reason to send someone to us. Oral candidiasis of unexplained cause. Mm-hmm. So again, that's generally indication that your immunity is low. And then oral hairy leukoplakia, which is a white sort of plaque that that occurs on the lateral side of your tongue. So you can't wipe this off, and that's caused by the EBV virus. And again, you know, anyone you see signs of that, they really need to go and have a HIV test.
Okay.
But again, you know, in a similar sort of way, try not to panic anyone, but it is worth making it obvious that, you know, this is something you need to rule out.
Mm.
Yeah. And send them to us. You don't need to talk about sex. Please don't go there. We will do all the contact tracing, talk about sex, all the rest of it, because that's, you know, that's what we're good at. We're rubbish at mouths and teeth, but we're very good at talking about...
Well, teamwork, you know. This is why it could work so well.
Exactly.
I think something you mentioned earlier was how our approach to sex and maybe having conversations about sex is informed by our upbringing, mm-hmm. our cultural background, our socialisation.
Yeah.
And obviously, I think there still will be people who are listening and thinking, still not quite convinced that I can do this.
Yeah.
What would your advice be to those who are feeling like that now, who perhaps have some internalised issues with talking about sex? How would you recommend that people get around that? Because obviously we are, I think a lot of people, I do still, you know, I'm not in healthcare in terms of a clinician like practicing, but I view healthcare professionals as superheroes, wrongly so sometimes, because you are human.
Yeah.
You know, so
yeah.
this reluctance to talk about sex isn't something that people should be embarrassed that they feel, but that they should want to perhaps overcome so that they can have these kinds of conversations or refer them to the right place without feeling embarrassed. What would you say they should do?
Well, I mean, I wasn't, you know, 16 years ago, I wasn't very good at talking about sex. It is a skill.
I don't believe that.
No, honestly. I was brought up in a house where, you know, we didn't talk about sex at all.
Yeah.
You know, my sex education was awful. I'm sure most people's sex education is awful. Yeah. So, you know, this isn't, I don't expect anybody to find this an easy subject, but I think you need to start practicing. So practice on your friends in the pub, or, you know, just trial out, you know, saying things. And it's funny, most people, when you say, I'm going to do your blood for HIV and syphilis as part of a screen, they go, oh, my GP did bloods last week. So often the lay public think we do bloods and it covers everything.
Mm.
So often, and most of the time, well, in fact, in the vast majority of the time, people just go, oh, okay, you know, and don't take, I think it's our internal worry
for sure
that we're going to upset somebody and, you know, stigmatize them.
Mm.
But that's our own internal concern. And also I'd say, you know, you don't have to agree with the type of sex or whatever, you know, is going on.
Yeah,
you're not being invited into their bedroom. It's a bit like, you know, you're a vegetarian or maybe vegan.
No, vegetarian. don't know why I got defensive. Wish I was vegan.
But, you know, that doesn't make me think, or hopefully you don't look at me and go, what a dreadful woman because I eat meat.
No, absolutely not.
You know, so I think we have to just be a bit more relaxed in, you know, I'm not going to force you to eat a chorizo sausage because I think you should, just as you're not going to, you know, rip it out of my hand and go, how dare you?
Yes, of course.
So, you know, maybe it's not the greatest analogy, but...
No, I think it is. I think it works. Yeah.
Yeah, but so I think we need, you know, and remember that we are healthcare professionals.
It.
You know, we are not doing our job if we do not refer people that you are concerned about syphilis or HIV on.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, ultimately it's... You know, I don't know how else to put that. We're not doing the job that we were trained to do if we're going to avoid certain situations because of our own internal
Absolutely.
Discomfort.
I think you mentioned oral cancer, and I think that's a really good way, good leveller,
yeah.
because oral cancer was a huge topic, but it's become increasingly on the radar since COVID,
yeah,
as a lot of things have, and a lot of oral cancer got missed during that period because obviously dental practices were shut for a good few months and the backlog's grown and things got missed and they developed, and sadly a lot of people have lost their life as a result or have now living with life-changing conditions and alterations. And I think that's a really good comparison. Would people let an oral cancer slide if you spotted it in a patient? No, I would hope the answer would be to that.
Yeah.
So that same approach should be taken when it comes to some of the conditions you've described today, I think.
Yeah. And also, I think it's, you know, it's just about knowing syphilis cases are on the rise.
Yeah.
So there will be ulcers and strange great mimickers of other things presenting to you as an oral health professional. Is that the right way to say it? An oral health professional?
Yeah. Or dental dentist team, or whatever.
You know, hygienist, you know, the whole bag.
Yes.
So,
yeah.
You know, also it's about education. So, you know, if you thought syphilis had gone out with the ark, which is how most people think, it's not even going to be on your radar.
Yeah, that's true.
So that's hopefully, you know, it's about education. It's about keeping up to date. You know, it's about listening to these great podcasts, which hopefully can, you know, just raise issues.
Absolutely.
And it's awareness, isn't it? It's awareness that things are changing and, you know, it may be that syphilis continues to rise and we see more of it, or, you know, we may develop a vaccine or develop PrEP for bacterial STIs, etc. So things will change. But again, I think it's just about making sure as a health professional, you are aware of all the changes in, you know, what you might be coming up against. And, you know, I really think syphilis is going to be a big one.
Education is important. So obviously educating yourself as a dental professional of these conditions, how they manifest, what to look out for, what to not look out for. Do you think it's also important to have this education available to patients too within the practice environment? So for example, you mentioned earlier some leaflets that you could give out, posters. Is this visibility an important element to sexual health in the practice?
That'd be amazing. Yes, 100%. I mean, I don't know that there's not as big a sort of a patient cohort of people with syphilis, but definitely people living with HIV want to see visible posters of, you know, HIV posters out, or you know, so visibility is hugely important. I mean, I'm not sure that you're going to get a big cohort of syphilis patients with syphilis going, I want a poster of my mouth in the waiting room, but yeah, you know, having leaflets of your local STI clinic, I think, would be a brilliant thing.
Yeah,
you know, just do it, get it done.
Do it. And what about the wider team? I think historically, dentists, talking about dentistry, can be very focused on the dentist, but we're seeing skills developed throughout the whole team now. Hygienists and therapists have been given a bigger scope of practice by the NHS last year. They're already have a lot of, huge significance in private practice, but also now within NHS teams. Yeah. Like I said, dental nurses are often at the forefront of patient communication, bringing them to and from the room. Well, about them, is it important for them to also
100%? And it's a bit, you know, I mean, within the NHS we have advanced nurse practitioners, physicians associates, so you know, all these roles are changing, it and it's everybody's responsibility to, you know. And also what I would say is, you know, if you're young and have listened to this podcast and you're a bit more up to date, and you ask a dentist who maybe is in their 60s and doesn't know syphilis is on the rise and goes, oh no, don't worry, it's not anything to worry about, please don't take that as, you know, if you feel that you know better, there's nothing wrong with whoever feel, you know. I think patient needs
definitely
to know.
Definitely.
Don't
let that hold you back, basically.
Don't let that hold you, I mean, you know, I had this, had one lady in her 50s who was seen by a nurse in her practice with an ulcer on the vulva. GP came in, oh, I don't know what it is, if it gets better, don't worry. And then she re-presented 6 months later with a widespread rash. Oh, maybe a virus, don't know what it is, if it gets better, don't worry.
Yeah.
And then she went and donated blood. And that was how the syphilis was picked up, and then she came to see us. But again, so, you know, if either the nurse or the doctor had thought, you know, well, maybe we should test for syphilis, just, you know, do it. It doesn't have to be, you know, a consultant or a dentist. It can be anybody who brings this conversation up if you feel, you know, able to.
Absolutely, absolutely. I think education comes from anyone. There could be people fresh out of university,
yeah,
who hopefully have listened to this podcast, or maybe, you know, have a better awareness of sexual health and how that can manifest in the mouth, who may be talking to, don't want to stereotype, but an older dentist who might not, like you said, 30 years ago, syphilis wouldn't have been on the radar, and now it is more than it was. I mean, I had no idea that that was the disease that
sex transmitted disease, infection. Okay. Infection becomes a disease, I suppose, when it's affecting you, but
so
infection is just,
that was most relevant, or one that you felt dental team should be most aware of at the moment. I'm not too sure what I thought it would be. It's not really a topic, I guess, I think about too much. But
the other thing I really want to stress is, please don't judge that person sitting in front of you, because sex is sex, and it doesn't have sex crosses all boundaries of social class, race, religion, common sense, marriage boundaries, you know. And so, you know, people can be a professional, be on benefits, you know, please don't judge people by race, class, or, you know, how they appear, because that is when you're going to get it wrong.
Absolutely.
If you see the ulcer, that's an ulcer. You don't care whose mouth it's in. I think that's a really important point to make.
Yeah, I think that's important too. Just to kind of round up the conversation, holistic healthcare is obviously something I feel you're quite passionate about. Now, let's ignore all the kind of boundaries and obstacles that in reality are there that may stop this effectively coming to play. Why is this something that you feel should be part of the future of healthcare in the UK and probably across the world? Why is referrals and things like that, why is that so important?
Well, just we all have to work together to try and, you know, it feels like there's more people and less of us, as in us being, you know, healthcare professional. Yeah. We're all under strain. We're all struggling with capacity. So I think we need to, gosh, I sound like a politician. We need to make every contact count. I'm sure someone said that. I don't know what. Goodness me.
Next career stepper, sexual health politician.
No, but again, you know, have the confidence to do what you can for that patient at the time. And then, you know, you can sleep easy at night. I think that's an important thing to consider.
As healthcare professionals, I mean, I'm not one, but I can imagine that is knowing you can go to bed and you've done your job and potentially saved
the
life.
Honestly, my job
must be
is
amazing.
The best job in the world.
Joe, there's so many questions that I want to ask you that I just feel aren't relevant to the conversation today. So probably call you up next week.
Pleasure, anytime.
Just let me know about this. But yeah, you've been absolutely wonderful. Thank you so much for making the long, long journey down.
With my bloodied knee.
Just disclaimer, you did fall over and you still made it here, so you get extra gold star for that one.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much.
Really
it's
lovely.
Been really enlightening and a conversation I don't think dentists have ever heard or have not heard enough, so hopefully it'll be super beneficial for them and they can go forward with confidence and make a change.
Oh, fingers crossed. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We asked dental professionals why they use Sensodyne for their sensitive teeth.
Find that Sensodyne is the best one.
I can enjoy my ice cream as I want to. I don't have to be afraid or embarrassed of my sensitivity.
I can eat my ice cream when I use the Sensodyne, and I can drink my cold gin and tonics.
It does the job.
79% of dentists with sensitive teeth trust Sensodyne to care for their teeth. Based on online research conducted in 2023, survey of 248 dental professionals, Haleon data on file. Sensodyne. Recommended by dentists. Used by dentists.